So, imagine this scenario. You walk into your broker's office and you ask them to wire, I don't know, $50,000 of your own money to an offshore account.
A completely standard request, on paper anyway.
Right. I mean, it earns your money. You earned it. You saved it. It belongs to you. But your broker looks at you, looks at the wire instructions, and says, "No, I am freezing your account. You cannot have your money."
Which in almost any other industry is just outright theft.
Exactly, or at least a massive lawsuit waiting to happen. But in the world of securities regulation, that broker might actually be, entirely legally protected. In fact, they might be doing exactly what the regulators want them to do.
Yeah, they're following the rule book to the letter.
So today we're going to tear down the illusion of safety in investing, explore exactly why your broker might legally freeze your assets, and really dig into the hidden risks that no one tells you about until it is way too late.
It's a deep one today.
Oh, it really is. But before we get into the weeds, a quick heads up. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend checking them out if you're prepping for the 82.
Definitely. Okay, so jumping in, it's an incredible paradox, isn't it? We operate in an industry that is totally built on the idea of client autonomy, yet we have rules that explicitly allow a firm to act as this, like, paternalistic guardian.
It is a paradox, yeah.
Yeah.
But to understand how we get to that extreme, we first have to understand the ecosystem those clients are operating in.
Right. And that is the core mission for this deep dive. If you are prepping for your Series 82 exam, you are used to looking at things in a vacuum, like a single trade. You look at a bond and ask, is this suitable?
It feels very clean,
Yeah.
very binary.
Yeah, binary. But in the real world, and especially on the harder questions of this exam, that vacuum just completely disappears. We are shifting gears from whether a single trade makes sense to looking at a customer's entire portfolio as a living, breathing machine. We are hunting for hidden risks, true costs, and mandatory disclosures.
Which is where the real complexity of the financial markets lives. I mean, a recommendation that easily clears the suitability hurdle at the individual trade level can still leave a client completely, just catastrophically exposed. When you zoom out to the portfolio level, we have to move from the micro to the macro.
Totally. So to help us navigate this, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters. We really need to ground these abstract rules in reality, so get familiar with these three. First, we have Riley the rep. Riley is a well-meaning registered representative who is just trying to follow the rules, serve her clients, and, avoid getting flagged by compliance.
Right, the quintessential broker just trying to survive in a heavily regulated environment.
Exactly. Next, we have Ingrid the investor. Ingrid is Riley's client. She has built up some capital over her life. Her primary goal is dependable income. She hates surprises, she hates volatility, and she thinks she knows what the word safe means.
But she has a whole lot to learn about the invisible forces eating away at her money.
She sure does. And finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam is the corporate issuer. He is the executive issuing the securities that Ingrid buys. And let's just be super clear about Sam's motivations. Sam is looking out for Sam.
Oh, always. He wants to borrow money as cheaply as possible, with as few strings attached as possible.
Right. The tension between Ingrid's desire for safety and yield and Sam's desire for cheap, flexible capital that is the engine that drives almost all of the complex securities regulations we are about to discuss.
It's the ultimate tug of war.
It is. And for you listening right now, look, I know studying for regulatory exams can feel like reading a dictionary. I have ADHD, and if you just read me a list of rules, my brain turns off in about 4 seconds flat.
Which is dangerous for the Series 82.
So dangerous. So we are doing this differently. We are going to use absurd hypothetical scenarios. We are going to argue about the mechanics of these rules, and I'm going to pause and ask you direct questions to force you to actively recall the material. You cannot just passively absorb this. You have to defend your answers.
I love that approach. Where do we start?
Let's start with the biggest illusion in finance, the illusion of safety. Ingrid goes to Riley and says, "Riley, I am terrified of the stock market. I refuse to lose a single dollar of my principal. I want safe, dependable income. I want to know exactly what I am getting every single year until I die."
Very common client request, honestly.
So Riley recommends a fixed-rate corporate bond. Ingrid buys it. It pays exactly $1,000 a year in interest, and it returns her principal at maturity. The nominal dollar amount never changes. So Ingrid thinks she is perfectly safe.
And she is completely 100% wrong.
Yep. By avoiding the visible volatility of the stock market, she has walked right into the jaws of a much quieter, much more destructive predator, inflation, or in the context of the exam, purchasing power risk.
Right.
Okay, but hold on. If she put in $20,000 and she gets exactly $20,000 back at maturity, plus a guaranteed $1,000 a year, her principal is physically intact. The account balance hasn't gone down. So what exactly is the risk?
The risk is the difference between nominal dollars and constant dollars. Nominal dollars are just the numbers printed on the paper, right? $1,000 is $1,000. But constant dollars represent what that money can actually buy in the real world. Purchasing power risk is the danger that rising prices in the broader economy will erode the real value of an investment's income and principal, even though the nominal payments stay exactly the same.
So let's use a ridiculous analogy here to make this stick. Imagine Ingrid's bond doesn't pay her in dollars. Imagine she gets paid in fixed amounts of pizza.
Okay, I'm listening.
She gets exactly 10 slices of pizza every single year. The nominal number 10 slices never changes. But every year, inflation means the physical size of those slices gets smaller and smaller. By year 10, she's still getting 10 slices, but they're like the size of a Ritz cracker.
That is actually a pretty perfect way to visualize constant dollars versus nominal dollars. The nominal count is 10.
Mm.
But the constant dollar value, the calorie she's actually getting, is shrinking rapidly.
Right. Let's ground this in a reality that hits home for retirees like Ingrid. Imagine she is relying on that $1,000 a year to pay for a specific necessary basket of goods. Let's say a month's worth of premium health insurance and prescription copays.
Very realistic.
In year one, her $1,000 bond interest perfectly covers those medical costs. But what happens over a 20-year bond maturity? Historically, medical costs outpace standard inflation. By year 10, that exact same basket of medical expenses might cost $1,500.
But her bond is still only paying her $1,000 nominal.
Right. The nominal number hasn't changed at all. Riley the rep can point to the statement and say, look, you haven't lost a dime. But in the real world, Ingrid is suddenly $500 short on her medical bills.
She has to pull from principal just to survive.
Exactly. By year 20, those medical costs might be $2,000. She is effectively taking a massive pay cut every single year. So on the exam, when they try to trick you by saying, the coupon payment never fluctuated, you have to recognize that the absolute lack of fluctuation is the very thing that guarantees her purchasing power is being destroyed.
Precisely. Fixed income investments, so bonds, preferred stock, cash equivalents, they carry the absolute greatest purchasing power risk precisely because their cash flows do not adapt to macroeconomic reality.
So if fixed income guarantees that Ingrid will slowly bleed purchasing power over time, what is Riley supposed to do? Like, how do we build a portfolio that actually protects her?
This brings us to the concept of the balanced portfolio. You have to mix components that respond differently to market and inflation conditions. If we look at the standard asset classes, they each serve a distinct structural role.
Let's pull those apart. We have bonds and preferred stock on one side, common stock on the other, and convertible securities sitting right in the middle.
Right. Bonds and preferred stock provide downside protection. Bonds give you a contractual legal claim to income and a return of principal. Preferred stock gives you a fixed dividend that has to be paid before common stockholders see a dime, and it has bond-like price stability.
They protect the nominal downside.
Yes. But, as we just discussed with the pizza slices, they leave you entirely exposed to inflation.
So to fix the inflation problem, Riley adds common stock to Ingrid's portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. Common stock represents an ownership stake in a business. As inflation rises, a company can generally raise the prices of the goods and services it sells.
Because things cost more, so they charge more.
Right. That leads to higher nominal earnings, which can translate into higher dividends and a higher stock price.
Yeah.
So common stock provides a natural inflation hedge.
But wait, now we've introduced a new problem. Ingrid explicitly told Riley she hates volatility. She hates surprises. Common stock prices swing wildly based on earnings reports, market sentiment, macroeconomic factors. So we fixed the inflation risk, but we completely destroyed her downside protection. We just traded one risk for another.
Which is why neither of those standalone components is a perfect solution. Not unless you look at a hybrid instrument, which is the convertible security, so a convertible bond or convertible preferred stock.
Ah, the shapeshifter of the financial world.
It is the only holding type that pursues both goals, downside protection, and an inflation hedge in a single package. As a bond, it has a par value, a fixed coupon, and it ranks ahead of equity and liquidation, providing that downside floor.
But it also carries an embedded option to convert into a fixed number of shares of the issuer's common stock, right? So if inflation rages and the company's stock skyrockets, Ingrid can basically hit a button, convert her bond into shares, and capture that upside. She gets the safety floor of the bond with the inflation hedging ceiling of the equity.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
And this is a major conceptual hurdle for the exam. The exam is going to ask you about the primary purpose of a balanced portfolio structure in the context of purchasing power risk.
Oh, this is a classic trap. I know this one. They will give you multiple choice answers about diversifying across different corporate sectors or holding bonds from 50 different issuers.
And you have to remember, diversification is about spreading issuer risk. A balanced structure in this specific regulatory context is about matching asset classes to the specific economic risks they mitigate.
So bonds and preferred stock equal downside protection. Common stock equals an inflation hedge. Convertibles equal both. That is the architecture of a balanced portfolio.
You nailed it.
Okay, let's pivot to another silent killer of returns. Because inflation isn't the only thing taking a massive bite out of Ingrid's income, the government is heavily involved in her portfolio S performance. Let's talk about taxability, because the stated yield on a bond is rarely the yield the client actually keeps.
Tax treatment fundamentally alters the intrinsic value of a security to a specific client. If you ignore the client's tax bracket, you are effectively flying blind on suitability.
Let's lay out the three main tax buckets for debt. Bucket number one, corporate bonds and bank interests.
Those are fully taxable at the federal, state, and local levels. They offer the highest stated yields because they have absolutely no tax advantages to offer the investor.
Bucket number two, U.S. Treasury securities.
The federal government taxes its own debt, so treasuries are fully taxable at the federal level. But by law, they are exempt from state and local income taxes.
And bucket number three, municipal bonds.
The interest from municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income tax. And if the investor lives in the state that issued the bond, that interest is typically exempt from state and local taxes as well.
Okay, I'm going to pause right here and put you on the spot. You are taking the test. The question says Riley the rep is looking at two bonds for Ingrid. The corporate bond pays a 6% yield. The municipal bond pays a 4% yield. The question asks, is the municipal bond automatically the better choice for Ingrid because it provides tax-free income?
I love this setup.
Just giving you a beat to think about it, is it automatically the better choice?
No.
Nope. The answer is an absolute, unequivocal no. Why? Because you don't have enough information to make that call. You cannot simply assume that tax-free is a magic word that beats everything else.
It's a mathematical relativity problem. The value of a tax exemption is entirely dependent on the marginal tax rate of the investor.
Exactly.
The higher your tax bracket, the more the government takes from a taxable bond, and therefore the more valuable a tax-free bond becomes to you.
Let's walk through the actual mechanics of this, because I want this to be intuitive for everyone listening, not just a memorized formula. Let's say Ingrid is in a relatively low tax bracket. Let's call it 15%. If she buys that 6% corporate bond, the government takes 15% of her yield.
All right, so 6% multiplied by 0.15 is 0.9%. The government takes 0.9%.
Which leaves Ingrid with a net after-tax yield of 5.1%.
And she is comparing that to a municipal bond offering a flat 4%.
Right. 5.1% after taxes still mathematically beats a 4% tax-free yield. For this low bracket version of Ingrid, the fully taxable corporate bond puts more actual spending money in her pocket. The tax-free muni is a terrible recommendation for her.
It really is. But now let's change her profile. Let's say Ingrid recently sold a highly successful business and she is now sitting in the highest marginal tax bracket. Let's say her combined federal and state tax rate is 40%.
Okay, let's run the same math. She buys the 6% corporate bond. The government takes 40% of her yield. So 6% multiplied by 0.40 is 2.4%. The government takes a massive 2.4% off the top,
leaving Ingrid with a net after-tax yield of only 3.6%.
Suddenly, that 4% tax-free municipal bond looks incredibly attractive. It beats the after-tax corporate yield by 40 basis points.
This is exactly why the exam uses the concept of the tax equivalent yield. It is a formula that forces you to compare apples to apples. It calculates exactly what a taxable bond would have to pay to equal the municipal bond's tax-free rate for a specific investor.
So what's the formula? Break it down.
The formula is the municipal yield divided by 100% minus the investor's tax bracket.
Okay, let's plug in the numbers.
So 4% divided by, in parenthesis, 1 minus 0.4, that os 4% divided by 0.60, which equals 6.67%.
What does that 6.67% actually mean in plain English?
It means that for this specific high bracket INGRID, a fully taxable corporate bond would have to offer a stated yield of 6.67% just to match the 4% she gets from the tax-free muni. Since the corporate bond in our example is only offering 6%, the muni is the mathematically superior choice.
So the takeaway for the exam is this. Never, ever recommend a municipal bond without confirming the client's tax bracket. The tax exemption is a tool. It's not a universal good.
Exactly. And speaking of tools that come with severe trade-offs, we really need to transition into the structural mechanics of the bonds themselves. Maturity and callability.
Yes. Let's reset for a second. Pattern interrupt. Shake off the tax math. Forget about inflation and taxes for a minute. We are now talking purely about the mechanics of time and interest rates. I want you to picture a seesaw, just a regular playground seesaw.
A classic finance analogy.
On one side is price risk. On the other side is reinvestment risk. The idea is that you can't push one side down without raising the other side up.
It is the inescapable reality of fixed income. You cannot construct a bond portfolio that is immune to both price risk and reinvestment risk simultaneously.
But let me play devil's advocate here. Why not? If I buy a bond at par and I hold it to maturity, the issuer pays me my full par value back. I didn't lose any money. Where is the price risk if I just hold it?
You are describing the accounting reality, but you are completely ignoring the economic reality of the secondary market.
Okay, explain that.
Price risk, which is often called interest rate risk, is the danger that rising interest rates in the broader economy will cause the market value of your existing bond to plummet.
Because new bonds are paying more, so nobody wants my old, low-paying bond.
Exactly. And maturity length is the multiplier for this risk. Think of a 30-year bond. You are locking your money up for 3 decades. If you buy a 30-year bond yielding 3%, and a year later the Federal Reserve hikes rates, or new 30-year bonds yield 6%, your 3% bond is now horribly unattractive.
Right. Nobody's going to buy a 3% bond when they can get 6% down the street.
To convince someone to buy it from you in the secondary market, you have to discount the price of your bond so severely that its yield to maturity matches the new 6% market rate. That price drop on a 30-year bond will be massive.
So even if Ingrid says, I'm just going to hold it, what if she has a medical emergency in year 5 and is forced to sell? She's going to take a catastrophic loss on her principal. That is price risk. The longer the maturity, the higher the price volatility.
So naturally, an investor like Ingrid might say, well, I hate that. I refuse to take price risk. Riley, only buy me 1-year bonds.
Okay, let's look at the other side of the seesaw. A 1-year bond has almost zero price risk. If interest rates change tomorrow, it doesn't matter much because Ingrid gets her full principal back from the issuer in just a few months anyway. The price won't deviate far from par.
But she has just maximized her reinvestment risk.
Reinvestment risk is the nightmare of having cash handed back to you when you don't want it. If Ingrid buys a 1-year bond at 6%, she feels great. But 12 months later, Sam the sponsor hands her principal back. If the economy has entered a recession and the Fed has slashed rates to zero, Ingrid is standing there with a bag of cash, and the only new 1-year bonds she can find are yielding 1%.
Her income just dropped by over 80% overnight.
That is the trade-off. Long maturity equals high price risk, but very low reinvestment risk because your money is locked in for decades. Short maturity equals low price risk, but massive reinvestment risk because you constantly have to find new homes for your cash at whatever the prevailing market rate happens to be.
So how does the industry attempt to solve this? They pitch a strategy called laddering.
A laddered portfolio distributes debt holdings across a staggered range of maturities. Instead of putting all her money into a 10-year bond, which we call a bullet strategy, just putting all your chips on one date, Ingrid buys a 1-year, a 3-year, a 5-year, a 7-year, and a 10-year bond.
The logic makes sense on the surface. Only a portion of her principal comes due at any one time. If rates have plummeted, she only has to reinvest a small fraction of her portfolio at the terrible new rates. The rest is still locked in at the older, higher rates.
But here is the critical distinction for the exam, and it is a trap they love to set. Laddering does not eliminate risk.
Absolutely not.
Wait. If I build a 10-year ladder and rates drop to near zero and stay there for a decade, like they did after the 2008 financial crisis, every single rung of my ladder is eventually going to mature and be forced to reinvest at near zero. I haven't mitigated the risk. I haven't cured the disease. I've just forced myself to suffer a slow death by 1,000 cuts instead of taking one big hit up front.
You've just perfectly articulated the reality of the strategy. Laddering does not eliminate reinvestment risk or price risk. It merely spreads the impact of the risk across a timeline. It smooths the volatility of the income stream, but it does not protect you from a sustained macroeconomic shift.
So if the exam offers a choice saying laddering eliminates or removes interest rate risk, cross it out immediately. It manages the risk by averaging it out over time.
Exactly. Okay, so that is how maturity dates work in a fair world. Now let's introduce the mechanism that makes the fixed income world profoundly unfair to the investor. Let's bring Sam, the sponsor, back in.
Oh boy.
Sam issues a callable bond.
Let's define that.
A call feature is an embedded option that gives the issuer, Sam, the right, but not the obligation, to redeem the bond and pay back the principal before the stated maturity date. The power rests entirely with the issuer.
Let's translate this into a mechanic that everyone understands, a home mortgage refinance. When do you refinance your house? You do it when interest rates drop. You take out a new, cheaper loan, and you use that money to pay off your old, extensive loan.
That is exactly what a corporate call feature is. Sam, the sponsor, borrows money from Ingrid by issuing a 20-year bond at 6%. 5 years later, macro interest rates drop to 4%.
Sam realizes he is overpaying for his debt.
Exactly. So he exercises his call feature, he forces Ingrid to give the bond back, he returns her principal, and he issues new bonds to other investors at the cheaper 4% rate.
This is a brilliant financial move for Sam, but think about the absolute cruelty of this for Ingrid. Sam's call feature hands the reinvestment problem to Ingrid at the exact mathematical moment that reinvesting is the least attractive.
Right, because she is forced to go back into the market to replace her 6% bond, but because rates have fallen everywhere, she can only find 4% bonds.
The call feature is the forced realization of reinvestment risk. It is a heads I win, tails you lose proposition for the issuer. If rates go up, Sam ignores the call feature and leaves Ingrid holding a low-paying bond with massive price risk. If rates go down, Sam calls the bond and forces Ingrid to suffer reinvestment risk.
Because of this inherent disadvantage to the investor, callable bonds generally have to offer a slightly higher coupon rate than non-callable bonds to entice investors to take on that asymmetrical risk. And they also come with a call protection period.
Okay, direct question to you, the listener. If Ingrid relies on this bond to pay her monthly living expenses, does she want a short call protection period or a long call protection period?
Give him a second to think.
Got your answer. She wants it to be as long as possible.
Yeah.
The call protection period is the initial span of years, say the first 5 or 10 years of the bond's life, during which Sam is legally prohibited from calling the bond, regardless of what interest rates do. It locks him out.
For an income-dependent client, a long call protection period is highly desirable because it guarantees the income stream for a longer baseline.
And remember the universal rule for the exam. Issuers call bonds when interest rates fall. They do to refinance. End of story.
It's all about the refi.
Okay, let's take a breath. We've covered how inflation destroys nominal returns, how taxes alter real yield, and how issuers use call features to weaponize interest rates against you. Now let's look at the other major embedded option in fixed income. We are moving into the shapeshifters again. Convertibility and forced conversion.
We touched on this earlier when we discussed balanced portfolios. A convertible bond gives the holder Ingrid the right to exchange the bond for a fixed number of shares of Sam's common stock.
But we know that in finance, options are never free. This convertibility is a massive superpower for Ingrid. If Sam's company discovers a new miracle drug and the stock goes up 500%, Ingrid can convert her boring bond into stock and participate in that massive upside. How does she pay for that privilege?
She pays for it via a lower coupon rate. Sam, the sponsor, knows the conversion feature is valuable, so he prices it into the bond. If a standard non-convertible bond from Sam yields 6%, his convertible bond might only offer 4%.
Ah, so Ingrid is consciously trading away current yield in exchange for a claim on future equity upside. Let's drill down into the math, because the Series 82 exam expects you to be able to calculate this on the fly. Let's say Ingrid buys a convertible bond with a standard par value of $1,000. The prospectus states the conversion price is $50. The first thing you need to find is the conversion ratio.
The conversion ratio is simply the number of shares Ingrid gets if she decides to convert. The formula is par value divided by the conversion price. So $1,000 divided by $50 equals 20. Her conversion ratio is 20 shares.
This ratio is fixed. It is set in stone when the bond is issued. No matter what happens in the market, one bond equals 20 shares. But how do we know what those 20 shares are actually worth on any given Tuesday?
That requires calculating the conversion value, which is also known as parity. This fluctuates every single day because it is tied to the stock market. The formula is the conversion ratio multiplied by the current market price of the common stock.
Let's run a scenario. Let's say Sam's company absolutely crushes its earnings report. The common stock price shoots up to $60 a share in the open market. What is the conversion value of Ingrid's bond right now?
We take a ratio of 20 shares and multiply it by the current market price of $60. 20 times 60 is $1,200. The conversion value of her bond is $1,200.
So even though the bond's par value is only $1,000, its intrinsic value is now $1,200 because she holds the legal right to flip it into $1,200 worth of stock. This is the dream scenario for a convertible bondholder.
It is right up until Sam, the sponsor, looks at his balance sheet, sees all these bondholders sitting on massive embedded equity gains, and decides to put a stop to it. Enter the concept of forced conversion.
Okay, alert, break the fourth wall for a second. This is perhaps the most heavily tested, most frequently misunderstood concept in this entire unit. The phrasing forced conversion tricks people every time. Let's set up the track.
Sam's stock is at $60. The conversion value of Ingrid's bond is $1,200, but this bond is also callable. So Sam exercises his call feature. The call price is set at a slight premium, let's say $150. Sam announces, "I am calling all convertible bonds. I am requiring you to surrender your bonds, and I will pay you $1,050 in cash."
So here is the exam question. In a forced conversion, who is actually executing the conversion? Does Sam, the sponsor, convert Ingrid's bond into stock for her?
No, absolutely not. The issuer never converts the bond. The issuer only issues a cash call. It is the holder, Ingrid, who actively chooses to convert the bond into stock.
Wait, I'm confused. If Ingrid is the one picking up the phone and saying, "Riley, please convert my bond," why in the world do we call it a forced conversion?
Because the mathematics of the situation leave a rational investor with no other choice. It is an economic forcing hand. Look at Ingrid's two options once Sam issues the call. Option A, she does nothing, the bond is called, and she receives $1,050 in cash.
And option B.
Option B, she exercises her right to convert the bond before the call date arrives. She gets 20 shares of stock, which she could immediately sell in the open market for $1,200.
Ah, $1,200 versus $1,050.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be economically irrational for her to accept the $1,050 call price when she can convert and capture $1,200 of value. The issuer's call forces her hand. She converts not because she necessarily wants to hold the stock, but because she refuses to throw away $150 of arbitrage value.
That is the key distinction. The mechanism of forced conversion is economic pressure. It's not a unilateral corporate action. Sam calls the bond. Ingrid chooses to convert. The exam will try to trick you into saying the issuer converts the bond mechanically. Don't fall for it.
But we also have to look at the portfolio consequences of this event. What actually just happened to Ingrid's carefully constructed balanced portfolio?
It just got blown to pieces.
Precisely. Let's look at the risk shift. Yesterday, Ingrid held a fixed income security. She had a contractual right to semi-annual interest. She had a maturity date where she was owed her principal. And crucially, if Sam's company went bankrupt, her bond was senior debt, she would be near the front of the line in liquidation court.
And today, because Sam decided to force her hand.
Today, she holds common stock. She has no contractual right to income. Income dividends are only paid if the board of directors feels like it. There is no maturity date. Her capital is committed indefinitely. And if the company goes bankrupt tomorrow, she is a common equity holder. She is dead last in the liquidation line. She gets nothing until every single creditor is paid.
Her investment objective hasn't changed. She still wants dependable income and safety, but her portfolio just underwent a violent risk shift, dictated entirely by the issuer's timeline. That is why forced conversion is considered a major portfolio risk, and why Riley needs to be acutely aware of the relationship between the call price and the conversion value.
A perfect summary.
Let's transition. Let's say Ingrid now holds this stock, and she decides she hates it. She wants to sell it. This brings us to a critical distinction that trips up even experienced professionals, the difference between marketability and liquidity.
It is very easy to blur these two concepts together because in casual conversation, we use them interchangeably. But in the context of regulatory suitability, they are entirely separate concepts.
Let's draw a hard line in the sand right now between the investment and the investor.
Good. Marketability is a property of the asset itself, the security. It asks a mechanical question. How easily and how quickly can this specific security be sold in the secondary market without suffering a massive price concession? It is an intrinsic characteristic of the legal and market structure of the asset.
So if I hold a share of Apple stock, it is highly marketable. There are millions of buyers and sellers trading it every second on highly efficient digital exchanges. I click sell, and the transaction is executed in milliseconds at the exact quoted bid price. The spread between the bid and the ask is pennies.
Correct. But now imagine you hold a restricted security, like a private placement unit in a startup company. There is no public exchange. You are legally restricted from selling it to just anyone. You have to find an accredited buyer, negotiate a price, and process complex paperwork.
Basically a nightmare if you need cash fast.
Right. If you need to sell it today, you might have to offer a 40% discount just to entice someone to take it off your hands. That asset has very low marketability.
Notice what the expert didn't mention just there. They didn't mention me. They didn't mention Ingrid. Because marketability has nothing to do with the investor. The Apple stock is highly marketable whether it's owned by a billionaire hedge fund or my grandmother.
Which brings us to the other side of the line. Liquidity need. Liquidity need is a property of the investor, the client. It asks a personal question. How soon does this specific person need to convert their holdings into cash to meet real-world obligations?
If Ingrid finds out she needs a $50,000 roof repair by next Tuesday, she has a high, immediate liquidity need. It doesn't matter what's in her portfolio. Her life circumstances dictate her need for cash.
And this separation is crucial for the exam. The exam loves to test your ability to match these two distinct concepts during a suitability analysis.
Okay, here comes the scenario. Let's say Riley the rep wants to recommend a private equity fund to Ingrid. The prospectus explicitly states that the investment has a 10-year lockup period and virtually zero marketability. Is this recommendation automatically unsuitable for Ingrid simply because the asset is unmarketable? Let them think. The answer is no. You cannot judge suitability based purely on the asset's marketability. You have to cross the line and look at the client's liquidity need.
Exactly. If Ingrid has $10 million in liquid cash sitting in a bank account and she tells Riley, take $100,000 and lock it up for 10 years, I absolutely will not need to touch it, then her liquidity need for those specific funds is zero.
Right.
In that scenario, recommending a highly unmarketable asset might be perfectly suitable, because the asset's lack of marketability perfectly aligns with their lack of liquidity need.
But if you flip the scenario and Ingrid only has $100,000 to her name and she might need it for medical bills next year, then putting her into an unmarketable private placement is a massive suitability violation.
The exam trap is assuming that low marketability equals bad investment. It doesn't. It just requires a client with a correspondingly low liquidity need. Keep the asset and the investor separate in your analysis.
Let's talk about the cost of executing these transactions, because this is an area where Fainara has spent a lot of time tightening the screws. When Riley buys or sells a bond for Ingrid, Riley's firm doesn't work for free. They have to make money. But the way they make money on bonds is often invisible to the retail client.
In an agency trade, where the firm just acts as a middleman connecting Ingrid to a seller, the firm charges a visible commission. It's a separate line item on the confirmation statement. It's very transparent. But the bond market is largely a dealer market. Firms often execute trades in a principal capacity.
Meaning the firm is trading out of its own inventory. If Ingrid wants to buy a corporate bond, Riley's firm doesn't go find a seller. The firm just sells Ingrid a bond that they already own on their own books.
And when they do that, they don't charge a separate commission. Instead, they build their profit into the price of the bond itself. This is called a markup. If the prevailing market price of the bond is $1,000, the firm might sell it to Ingrid for $1,020. That $20 is the firm's profit.
But to Ingrid, she just sees a single number on her confirm. Price, $1,020. She doesn't know what the true market value was, and she doesn't know how much of a cut the firm took. It's an embedded cost.
Which is why Fainara instituted strict markup disclosure rules. Under certain highly specific conditions, the firm is legally required to drag that hidden profit out into the light. They have to explicitly state on the client's confirmation statement exactly how many dollars and what percentage they marked up the bond.
But this isn't a blanket rule. It doesn't apply to every single bond trade. Fainara created a very precise four-part trigger. If you are taking the Series 82, you have to memorize these four conditions, because if even one of them is missing, the firm doesn't have to disclose the markup.
Let's walk through the trigger. Condition number one, the transaction must be executed in a principal capacity. As we just discussed, if it's an agency trade, they are already disclosing the commission, so this rule is irrelevant.
Got it. Firm is trading from inventory. Condition number two.
It must involve a corporate or agency debt security. This specific disclosure rule targets those markets.
Okay. Corporate or agency debt. Condition number three.
The trade must be with a non-institutional customer.
Meaning a retail client, like Ingrid. FanTriArray figures that massive institutional hedge funds have the tools and the market power to figure out if they are being ripped off. Retail clients like Ingrid don't, so the protection is focused on retail.
Exactly. And now we get to condition number four, which is the operational linchpin of the whole rule. The firm must have bought or sold that identical security in an offsetting transaction at a size equal to or greater than the customer's trade on the exact same trading day.
Let's unpack the mechanics of that because it sounds like legal jargon. Why does Actuary care if it happened on the same day?
It's about riskless principal trading. Imagine Riley's firm gets a call from Ingrid wanting to buy $50,000 of a specific IBM bond. The firm doesn't own it. So the firm's trading desk immediately goes to the broader market, buys $50,000 of the IBM bond for their own inventory at 98, and then 10 minutes later, turns around and sells it to Ingrid out of inventory to 100.
The firm took almost zero market risk. They just acted as a toll booth, holding the bond for 10 minutes and pocketing a massive two-point spread.
Exactly. Finera looks at that same-day offsetting trade and says, "We know exactly what your cost basis was. We know exactly what your profit margin is. It was essentially a riskless flip. Therefore, you must disclose that markup to the retail client."
But what if the firm bought that IBM bond 6 months ago, held it in inventory, took the risk of the price going up or down for half a year, and then sold it to Ingrid today?
In that case, there is no same-day offsetting trade. The firm took legitimate inventory risk. The four-part trigger is broken, and the firm does not have to disclose the explicit dollar and percentage markup on the confirm.
So to summarize the four-part trigger, say it with me. Principal capacity, corporate or agency debt, retail customer, and a same-day offsetting trade. If you have all four, you disclose the markup. Are there any exceptions to this, even if you hit all four triggers?
There are two narrow exceptions. First, if the customer trade was executed by a principal trading desk that is functionally separate from the desk that executed the firm's own offsetting trade, and they have strict information barriers in place to keep the desks unaware of each other's activities.
Basically, the retail desk truly didn't know that the institutional desk happened to buy the exact same bond that morning. It was a coincidence, not a coordinated flip.
Right. The second exception is if the firm sold the security to the customer at the fixed price of a registered fixed price offering on the exact day it acquired the security from the syndicate. In that case, the price is set by prospectus anyway, so the specific markup disclosure is waived.
Now, I want to clarify something because the exam will try to blur the lines here. That four-part trigger is just for the specific dollar and percentage markup disclosure. But there are broader debt confirmation rules that apply much more widely, right?
Yes. For all corporate and agency debt transactions with non-institutional customers, regardless of whether there was a same-day offsetting trade or not, the confirmation statement must include two specific pieces of information. First, a reference and a hyperlink, if the confirm is electronic, to FINRA's TRACE public trade data page for that specific security.
TRACE is FINRA's reporting system, so even if the firm doesn't explicitly state their markup, they are giving Ingrid a link where she can go look at every other trade that happened in the market that day and figure out for herself if she got a fair price.
Precisely. It provides ambient transparency. And the second requirement is that the confirm must state the execution time of the transaction down to the exact second.
Okay, let's lock this in. Direct question to the listener. If Riley sells a bond to Ingrid from inventory that the firm has held for 3 months, do they need to put the FINRA hyperlink and the execution time to the second on the confirm?
Wait for it.
Yes. The hyperlink and the execution time are required for all retail, corporate, and agency debt trades. The four-part trigger, specifically the same-day offsetting trade requirement, only dictates whether they have to mathematically calculate and display the explicit markup percentage. Keep those two levels of disclosure separate in your mind.
Excellent distinction. Now, while we are on the topic of costs, we should briefly touch on the fees outside the actual trade execution, the ancillary fees.
Right, because Riley's firm does a lot of administrative work. They hold Ingrid securities in safekeeping, they process account transfers, they collect dividends and clip coupons on her behalf. Can the firm charge for that?
They absolutely can. But FINRA rules dictate that charges for these ancillary services must be reasonable and not unfairly discriminatory between customers.
Okay, exam trap flag. Does FINRA provide a schedule of maximum allowable dollar amounts for these fees? Like, can they say a firm may not charge more than $75 for an outgoing account transfer?
No. There are no fixed dollar caps in the rule. It is a principles-based standard. Reasonableness is evaluated based on the facts and circumstances of the service provided, the firm's costs, and industry norms.
And what does not unfairly discriminatory mean in practice?
It means you have to treat similarly situated customers the same. If Riley's firm charges Ingrid $50 for a safekeeping service, but charges another client with the exact same account size and profile $500 for the identical service, that is unfairly discriminatory. You can't just arbitrarily gouge one client.
And do not confuse this standard with the fair pricing rule. The fair pricing rule, or the 5% policy, governs the price or commission charged on the actual execution of a securities trade. This reasonable and non-discriminatory standard governs the administrative ancillary fees. Put them in separate mental buckets for the exam.
Good advice. Now let's circle all the way back to the scenario we opened the show with. We're moving into segment 6, protecting the vulnerable and the rules surrounding temporary holds.
Let's replay the tape. Ingrid calls Riley. She sounds confused, frantic, and she is demanding that Riley immediately liquidate $50,000 of her safe, dependable bonds and wire the cash to a random, unverified offshore bank account. Riley hears someone in the background whispering instructions to Ingrid. Riley is 99% sure that Ingrid is the victim of an active financial exploitation scam.
It is a broker's worst nightmare.
Now, traditionally, a broker-dealer is an agent of the client. If the client demands their money, you give them their money. If Riley simply refuses to process the wire and freezes the account, isn't she violating a massive stack of FINRA and SEC rules? Isn't that the improper use of customer funds?
Historically, yes. Firms were caught in a terrible legal bind. If they processed the wire, the client lost their life savings. If they froze the account to stop the theft, the client or the scammer acting through the client could sue the firm for conversion, breach of contract, or violating customer account transfer rules.
So FINRA created a legal shield, FINRA Rule 2165.
Exactly. It operates on the legal concept of a safe harbor. The rule states that if a firm strictly follows a very specific set of procedures and timelines, they are granted a safe harbor from being prosecuted or sued for freezing the client's money.
But this doesn't apply to every client. Riley can't just freeze my account because I want to buy a stupid sports car.
Right.
The client has to be a specified adult. What is the definition?
A specified adult is defined as any natural person age 65 or older. Age alone qualifies them.
Okay, what if the client is 40 years old, but they have severe early onset dementia?
They also qualify. The second half of the definition includes any natural person age 18 or older whom the firm reasonably believes has a mental or physical impairment that renders them unable to protect their own interests.
And how does Riley prove that impairment? Does she need a doctor's note?
No, that would be impossible in a fast-moving crisis. The rule allows the firm to rely on their reasonable belief based on the facts and circumstances of their business relationship with the client. If Riley has known Ingrid for 10 years, and Ingrid suddenly doesn't know where she is or who she is talking to, Riley's observation is sufficient to trigger the reasonable belief.
Okay, so Ingrid is a specified adult. Riley suspects exploitation. Notice the rule is permissive. It's not mandatory. It says the firm may place a temporary hold. It doesn't force them to. It just gives them the tool. So Riley and her supervisor use the tool. They freeze the outgoing wire. Now we enter the timeline. And look, the exam is going to test you mercilessly on the exact number of days in this timeline.
The structure of the timeline is the price the firm pays for the safe harbor. Because freezing a client's money is a massive infringement on their autonomy, the regulators force the firm to constantly justify the hold.
Grab a mental notepad right now. You have to memorize the stack in order. Step 1. Riley places the hold today. What is the very first deadline on the clock?
Notification. Within 2 business days of placing the hold, the firm must notify all parties who are authorized to transact business on the account. And they must notify the client's designated trusted contact person.
Wait, what if Riley suspects that the trusted contact person is the one orchestrating the scam?
The rule accounts for that. You do not notify anyone whom you suspect is involved in the financial exploitation. But that 2 business day notification clock is step 1.
Step 2, the hold is in place. How long does the initial freeze last based purely on Riley's initial suspicion?
The initial hold lasts for up to 15 business days.
Why 15 days? Why not 5 or 60?
Because 15 business days is roughly 3 calendar weeks. It is enough time for the firm to freeze the immediate bleeding, lock down the assets, and immediately initiate an internal review of the facts. The firm has to use those 15 days to investigate.
Okay, so they are investigating. They look at IP addresses on the login. They review phone recordings. But let's say it is a highly sophisticated, multi-layered scam. 15 days is almost up, and the firm hasn't cracked it yet, but they are confident the scam is real. Can they get more time?
Yes. Step 3 is the first extension. If the firm's internal review supports the initial reasonable belief of exploitation, the firm can extend the hold for up to 10 additional business days.
Okay, let's do the math. 15 initial days plus 10 extension days. We are now at a total of 25 business days. What did it take to unlock those extra 10 days?
Just the internal review. The firm's own compliance and legal departments looking at the facts and deciding, yes, this is real, we need more time.
But what if 25 days still isn't enough? Scammers are patient. Law enforcement moves slowly. Can the firm hold it even longer?
This is where the bar gets significantly higher. Step 4 is the second extension. To get more time beyond the 25 days, the firm can no longer rely solely on its own internal judgment. To unlock the second extension, the firm must have reported the matter to a state regulator, an adult protective services agency, or a court of competent jurisdiction.
They have to bring in outside authorities.
Exactly. If they have involved the state or the courts, and their internal review still supports the hold, they can extend it for up to 30 additional business days.
Okay, let's tally the absolute maximum timeline under the firm's own power. 15 initial days, plus a 10-day extension based on internal review, plus a 30-day extension based on an outside report. That is a maximum of 55 business days total.
Correct. And to be clear, a state regulator or a judge can step in at any point and order the hold to be terminated immediately or extended indefinitely, completely superseding this FANRA timeline.
Let me summarize this because you have to have this locked in your brain for exam day. The notification is 2 days, the hold sequence is 15, then 10, then 30. Do not mix up what unlocks the 10 versus the 30. Internal review gets you the 10, external report gets you the 30.
And you must remember the supervisory requirements. Riley cannot do this on her own authority. The firm must have written supervisory procedure specifically for this rule.
Yeah.
They must designate, by title, exactly who is authorized to place, terminate, or extend a hold. And that person must serve in a supervisory, compliance, or legal capacity.
The record keeping must be an absolute nightmare.
Oh, it is extensive. The firm must retain records of the original request, the findings of the reasonable belief, the name and title of the person who authorized the hold, proof of all the notifications, the documentation of the internal review, and records of any communications with state agencies. If a firm utilizes this safe harbor, FINRA examiners are going to scrutinize that file line by line to ensure they didn't just freeze an account because they were lazy or vindictive.
It is a massive legal machinery built to solve a very human problem.
All right, we have covered an enormous amount of ground today. We are moving into the outro. It is time for the rapid-fire recap. Let's hammer the absolute top testable takeaways from this entire macro portfolio unit. Go.
First, the balanced portfolio. Bonds and preferred stock protect against downside principal risk. Common stock hedges against inflation. Convertible securities are the only instruments that provide both downside protection and an inflation hedge in a single package.
Next, taxes. Municipal bonds are not universally better just because they're tax-free. Their suitability depends entirely on the investor's marginal tax bracket. You must use the tax-equivalent yield formula to compare them apples to apples against fully taxable corporate bonds.
Third, maturity and the yield curve. Long-term bonds carry massive price risk if interest rates rise. Short-term bonds carry massive reinvestment risk if interest rates fall. Laddering a portfolio smooths these risks across time, but it absolutely does not eliminate them. Fourth, callability. Issuers call bonds when macroeconomic interest rates fall, so they can refinance their debt cheaper. This is great for the issuer, but it forces reinvestment risk onto the investor at the worst possible time. Income-dependent clients value long call protection periods.
Fifth, forced conversion. This is an economic choice actively made by the bondholder, not a mechanical action taken by the issuer. The issuer calls the bond, and the math forces the holder to choose conversion to capture the higher value. This causes a massive risk shift in the portfolio, moving the client from senior debt to junior equity.
Sixth, marketability versus liquidity. Marketability is a characteristic of the security itself, how easily it trades in the secondary market. Liquidity need is a characteristic of the specific client, how fast they need cash. Do not assume a private placement is unsuitable simply because it has low marketability. It might perfectly match a client with zero liquidity needs.
Seventh, markup disclosures. The four-part trigger requires explicit dollar and percentage markup disclosure on a retail confirm if the firm traded in a principal capacity, in corporate or agency debt, with a non-institutional customer, and executed a same-day offsetting trade of equal or greater size.
And finally, temporary holds. The specified adult timeline stacks as follows. 2 business days to notify authorized parties. 15 business days for the initial hold. plus 10 business days if an internal review supports it, plus 30 additional business days if the firm reports the exploitation to an outside state agency or court.
Perfect. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you continue your exam prep. Look at the massive philosophical tension baked into these regulations. On one side, you have rules like the markup disclosures and the FINRA trace hyperlinks. Those rules are fundamental libertarian. They force the firm to provide raw data, and they treat the client like a fully autonomous adult who is responsible for analyzing that data and making their own rational choices.
Here is the math. You figure it out.
Exactly. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have the temporary hold rule. That rule is deeply paternalistic. It explicitly allows the firm to override the client's direct instructions, freeze their assets, and treat them like someone who is incapable of protecting themselves.
It's a total contradiction.
It is. The regulatory framework straddles the line between radical transparency and protective paternalism. And your job as a Series 82 licensed professional is to know exactly which side of that line you are standing on in any given scenario. Understanding that underlying tension makes memorizing the specific rules infinitely easier.
That is an incredible way to frame it. At the beginning of this deep dive, we talked about moving from the micro vacuum of a single trade to the macro ecosystem of a portfolio. By now, I hope you see how all these invisible forces, inflation, taxes, yield curves, embedded options, and regulatory safe harbors interact to shape that ecosystem. You aren't just memorizing definitions for a multiple choice test. You are learning the actual mechanics of how to protect the Ingrid the investors of the world from the Sam the sponsors. Keep grinding through those practice questions, focus on the why behind the what, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.